I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today on Smart City, we're talking about neighborhood change. We'll speak with two people who are bringing change to their neighborhoods in very different ways. Marty Sumner is the chief of staff of the High Point, North Carolina Police Department. A decade ago, street-level drug dealing and criminal activity were rife in his town. The police force was both ineffectual and it had alienated the community. Major Sumner's groundbreaking technique for getting drug dealers off the streets has reduced violent crime and won the department a 2007 Harvard Innovations Award. And we'll speak with Julia Kim. She's the executive director of the Friends of the Bloomingdale Trail. Her organization is striving to take an unused elevated train line on the west side of Chicago and turn it into a 3-mile park and walkway. We'll talk to her about using this unconventional green space to connect neighborhoods. That's all today on Smart City, right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. From time to time here on Smart City, we like to check in with the trendsetters at the Government Innovators Network at Harvard. And who better to introduce our first guest today than Steve Goldsmith? He's the former mayor of Indianapolis who now directs the Innovations in American Government program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.
Today we're dealing with an issue that affects all cities, which is drug dealing and drug markets. I was a district attorney before I was mayor, and all of us have participated in those capacities in drug sweeps, trying to reduce the amount of drug violence, trying to help neighbors who are fearful to walk on the streets of their neighborhood because of the drug dealers. And we've also seen how this is a kind of a temporary solution where those arrested return to the corners relatively quickly. The Innovations in American Government program at Harvard gave an award, its Innovations Award, to the city of High Point for its overt drug market strategy. And what was interesting about that, and you'll hear about it in a minute, is it combined crime mapping and community policing, and actually in accord with drug dealers, a confrontation strategy where the drug dealers were brought in, faced the police, faced the authorities, and were told what the consequences would be for continuing the work of drug dealing on those neighborhoods. And what High Point saw was when that occurred, those street corners became safe again. A dramatic difference between that and just street-level sweeps where the offenders go back and ply their trade and scare the neighbors. Listen just a little bit about the overt drug market strategy of the city of High Point, North Carolina.
Marty Sumner is the chief of staff of the High Point, North Carolina Police Department. You've done something in High Point, North Carolina that many communities want to do, and that's reduce violent crime. First, let me ask you, what most often leads to violent crime?
It's this direct connection with open-air drug dealing is what was driving a lot of the violent crime in the neighborhoods where we've applied this type of strategy. And it's when dealers are out in the open and they're in competition with other dealers, selling one dose at a time to people they don't know. They're carrying guns, they're on edge, and that leads to street robberies, that leads to aggravated assaults, that also led to homicides and was driving a vast majority of the violent crime in those neighborhoods.
Wow. You know, help me understand, you know, what goes on there. I mean, is this, you didn't pay me, so I'm going to shoot you? Is it, you know, you're in competition with me, I'm going to shoot you? I mean, help me really understand what goes on there, because I don't know.
It is literally all of the above that you just mentioned. You have some dealers who protecting their cash. Let's face it, these guys generate cash, and the people around them know that. So they're as likely to be robbed as they are to be arrested. So they carry guns to protect their cash. They carry guns to protect their turf. Occasionally, because in particular crack cocaine is one of the drugs sold openly, because those addicts have to get hooked up so many times a day. These guys sometimes will use weapons to threaten and coerce and get their money out of the customers. And then it also brings in prostitution of people who are addicted, and then they turn tricks to get the money to go back to the dealer to get their dope. So all these things, this market feeds all of this, and it's out in the open, and it's so harmful to the community. I mean, all the economic damage is just devastating. And it's that strong dynamic, the market itself, where the customers have a reason to be there because they can get hooked up, and the dealers have a reason to be there because they can make sales. It's what keeps this thing fueled.
Marty, one of the things that I think vexes a lot of people, including me, is if everybody in the neighborhood knows where the crack house is or knows where the open-air market is for drugs, it's sort of like, well, why don't the cops know? Are the cops so out of touch? Are they getting paid off? Are they just ignoring it? Are they too busy to care? From a citizen standpoint, I think there's a view of, well, I know it, why don't they? Give me the police perspective.
Some of the people in the neighborhood do. They're afraid. First of all, they're afraid of these dealers and they're intimidated. They also sometimes have misunderstandings. They do believe, well, it's done out in the open, so the officers must know. There must be some type of conspiracy going on. Or they'll think, I called, and 30 minutes later I saw a patrol car drive by, but nothing happened. They didn't do anything to those guys. These are the types of misunderstandings that the community has. And, you know, they actually, I've had some community members say, and this is a direct quote, we see you working, we see you working hard, but nothing ever changes. The situation persists, so we've lost our faith in your ability to impact this problem. And they don't call anymore. And one of my questions was to the very first community group was, where's your outrage? How did you lose your outrage? They're not going to do this in front of my house. I'm going to call. I'm going to continue to call. I'm going to demand something be done.
But why should they have to demand? I mean, why should someone have to call three times to get the police to pay attention to this?
They shouldn't have to call three times. But what some of these callers didn't understand when we invited them back to do it with us, they're our eyes and ears. What they were not understanding is, let's take that call where the officer doesn't come for 30 minutes. Calls were stacked up. He was on a priority call. He couldn't get there. The anonymous caller described a condition he didn't see when he gets there. So their misunderstanding was he didn't do anything. When he gets there 30 minutes later, which was as quickly as he got the call dispatched, he don't see what they reported. And so part of this work is getting past all these misunderstandings and have this direct communication and then get this honest commitment that if you guys will call, here's what we're willing to do, and we won't leave you, and we will be there to help you. And breaking that barrier is the first step to getting these neighborhoods back on to the track they should be.
Tell me the outcome you were able to achieve.
By shutting down the overt market, by eliminating the dealers and the customers from coming to this neighborhood, we have been able to reduce the violent crime in these neighborhoods on average 35% sustained for years now. The very first neighborhood we applied this to, West End, the anniversary is 4 years on May the 18th, 2008, so this past Sunday. Comparing the violent crime data before that date, 4 years, to the 4 years after that date, there's been 57% reduction in violent crime in that neighborhood.
Wow.
Before that date, there were 5 homicides. After, there hasn't been a homicide in 4 years.
Okay. Where people didn't stop doing drugs. What happened? Where did it go? Did crime rise in some other neighborhood? What happened?
Actually, we don't see any evidence of displacement for the dealers because we track each dealer that is notified and is confronted. Now, I know we've displaced customers, but what we did was we eliminated the market. Is there still drug use in that neighborhood? I'm sure there is, but you don't have it fueled by guys on the corner who are armed. You don't have it fueled by a crack house or curbside service or prostitutes. All that has gone away and led to those reductions, which has been very easy to sustain.
Wow. Okay, so how did you turn your policing from an unfocused effort to an effort focused on closing down this open drug dealing that was going on?
Our good friend David Kennedy with John Jay College, he's the one who came up with this theory. He sat down with us and he said, what if? And he says, if I could show you a way that we could use focused deterrence and we could close the market and you could get the violence reductions with minimal numbers of arrests with the community's approval, would you be interested? We said, absolutely. So we sat and we listened, and what he was saying made sense to us. And we had tried everything that we had ever thought of. I'm a 24-year veteran. Everything was enforcement-oriented. Many times the crackdowns, the sweeps, appear to be very harsh to the community. And if we were getting the results we had always wanted, it would have been worth it. But we were not getting the results we wanted. We said, okay, we're going to make sure that we pick the worst neighborhood in town first, apply it there. We used a year's worth of data, different layers of crime reports, and put a merged density map together and said, that's the neighborhood we're going to go to first. Because we could imagine some neighborhoods would say, we don't want to be labeled that way, or other neighborhoods might want to say, we're first. We said, no, it's going to be data-driven and very focused, and so we let the data pick the neighborhood.
Once you picked the neighborhood, what did you do?
After we picked the neighborhood, we go out and we surveyed the officers and probation and vice and said, who are these guys involved in driving this drug trade? It's out in the open. You guys know. Give us a master list.
So you had a list of names.
We had a list of names. Everybody, these guys are out in the open. They're not hiding, so people know who they are. Then we investigate each one of them, and we look at their record, and we discuss, you know, what is their violent history? What charges do they have pending? Or are they a retail-level dealer who just has some drug charges, maybe some property crimes? Maybe this guy we can turn. Some we're going to have to make examples out of and prosecute. But the others who, in the ordinary way we would do business, would step up. We're going to put some deterrence against them. And each one of them is investigated, and we do pretty much a complete dossier. And we sit down in the room, and we decide, are these guys the guys that we're going to prosecute and make examples out of? Or are they going to be called in and given this deterrence message and offered help?
And it worked.
We have had huge success. And one of the great things about this is it's a relatively few number of people involved. From the outside looking in, you think it's just going to be hundreds of people. And how is that going to be manageable? When we actually did our homework and investigated each and every person involved in that retail market, and we're talking about four city blocks, the beginning, it was only a dozen people that we needed to call in and four people that we needed to prosecute. That many people was driving the market.
Wow. And so the eight that you didn't prosecute, were you getting them to give you information? Was that the purpose of the eight?
During the investigation phase, we discovered some of those were no longer active in that area. The names had been provided, but no longer involved. And some of them already had pending charges that on their next trip to the courthouse, they're not going to be a problem for the neighborhood. So when we get down to this list of the 16 we do want to deal with, we make undercover buys from each one of them. We tried to make several buys from each one of these guys, except we don't get a warrant. We don't draw a warrant. We don't draw the charge then. We bank that case because we're going to need a real predictable consequence to put before them the night of the call-in.
Now, bank the case. Tell me what that means. I don't understand that language.
I buy drugs from you twice. I've got videotaped, audio tape. Your case summary is completely ready to go for prosecution, but we don't draw a warrant. We don't arrest you. Instead, we come out there and we visit with you and a family member with a letter from the chief of police and say, you're in trouble. You've been caught up in a sting. We're no longer going to tolerate open-air drug dealing in this neighborhood. If you come to this meeting this one night, you're going to get a one-time offer of help. And please bring your family member, bring whoever has influence on you with you. The rules are being changed for you. And we think it's fair that we tell you first that the rules are being changed. And you're not going to be arrested on this particular night. But you're going to come in there and you're going to make a choice because we're not going to tolerate this any longer and the community's not either. So we're holding an arrest that could be made as a deterrent consequence if they don't take the community's help and listen.
And the community's help in the form of what?
Whatever they need. And community rallied together and they decided the most of the needs were the obvious: education or employment or housing or transportation.
How about rehab?
Most of these guys were dealers but not users.
Really?
Right.
So your dealers weren't users?
Right. So these were the needs we anticipated they would need. most of these are in every community has a lot of these services, but they're not focused. They're not very well focused, and they're certainly not focused for this population. These guys don't make appointments very often, and they're not good with phone trees, and they're just not going to do it. So we decided, hey, if the community will bring their services in, we'll have a one point of contact resource coordinator that these guys can hook up with to get whatever they need. And when they come to that meeting tonight, they can show, they can put it on a resource needs sheet. Here's what I need to quit. And that community group would try to provide that.
Now, do you hold that case file there so that if they don't do what they say they're going to do, you can step back in and arrest them?
That's exactly right.
And how did you coordinate the services? Does one community nonprofit agency or government agency, is that the point of contact for all of the people who need help, or and then all the other services funnel through them, or do you have different agencies taking different clients? How'd that work?
It was different agencies who came to the table to contribute whatever their specialty was.
Right.
And they agreed that, and it's actually now a city position, it's a part of the city employment, it's under community development housing. One person was the single point of contact, and all the services would be funneled through that resource coordinator. So you had Employment Security Commission, you had Caring Services, you had all these different agencies who could provide some service to these guys coordinated through one person.
Well, let me ask you something. How much do these guys make? I mean, the guys you dealt with, the dealers, what do they make in a year?
That's the thing. It was kind of interesting. These retail guys, they don't make a tremendous amount of money.
Well, what do they make?
They might make $100 a day or something, maybe a little bit more. But it was disposable cash. We found that these guys, they were not paying mortgages and they were not supporting families. It was disposable cash, food, clothes, cars, those kinds of things. A lot of them didn't even have cars. So I guess it's kind of like, Oscar Mayer, they make a lot of money selling hot dogs, but the guy on the corner with the little cart, he doesn't make that kind of crazy money. But the big distributor does. The guys in the neighborhood who are distributing ounces and kilos, those are the guys we're going to prosecute. We're going after them. They make the money. But these guys, when they really looked at how many times they've been to the courthouse, the lawyer fees, all the costs, they weren't making that much money.
Well, so what's the deal you're really offering people?
What I found is some of these guys were terrified to be out there.
Really?
They would never admit it to their friends because of the peer group so strong, but they are afraid of going to jail, and they're worried about being robbed, and they are afraid of being shot, but they had no idea of how to get out of it. They didn't know where to turn, and certainly you can't be, if five of us deal drugs together, you're not going to be the first guy that says, hey, let's all go straight tomorrow. That ain't going to happen.
Right.
So many of them were so happy to get an opportunity. So what I'm offering is an opportunity. And what you're headed towards, if you want to look at how much you make, consider how much you make in prison an hour. Considerably less than minimum wage. And consider the damage done to your family, because while you're in prison, somebody else has got to take care of your children. Consider how much they do the time with you. So it's an opportunity that the community really offers these guys. I'll just tell you, some of them, nobody had ever told them it was wrong. They never had another job. They didn't start out with bagging groceries. This was the only thing they'd seen. They had done it, and nobody had ever really set them down from the community and said, what you're doing is wrong. What you're doing hurts us. We want you to stop, but we love you, and we want to try to help you. They never heard that before.
Did you get pushback from your officers on this?
We spent a lot of time going around to the officers and explaining what we were proposing to do. And the first question the chief and the other majors asked was, will you support this? Because we decided immediately, if the officers at work of this department don't think it's a good idea and won't support it, can't happen. It could be the greatest idea, but it can't happen. I think they're very progressive. The vast majority said, well, you know what? Everything else we've tried gets no results, so why not? Let's try it. And for the leadership, we said, you know, the worst thing that's going to happen is we may look foolish. Well, that won't be the last time. But if we get the results that's possible, it will have all been worth it.
Did you resist trying to get press attention in the planning stage? I mean, did you do all this very quietly until you started to get results?
Resist? No. We actually thought this will be way too complicated to explain in one story the day after we had the call-in. So our thought was, if we can, we got a local paper and we met with the editor and said, we're going to have a story here. We think this is going to be something you could do a series of articles on. If you'll give us a commitment that you won't publish any of this, we'll let you be with us during the process so you can actually write a series of articles. And he agreed, and I thought that probably worked out very well because it would have been very, very difficult to do after the fact, but he understood it very well, the reporter did.
You know, I would think every community would like to have the results you have gotten. So here's a question. What can other communities learn from your experience?
There is something that can be done about a two-decade drug market. That's the first place we tried it. It had been 2 decades people were able to buy drugs there openly. I don't think High Point is a magical place with the perfect mix of people that can't be replicated. We have seen this replicated in almost a dozen other cities now across the country. They get similar results because the elements are there very specifically built up to make examples of a few, deter the rest, break the market dynamic. I would say there is something to be done. One of the things you got to consider is the police department really has to drive it, I think. We have the data. We can make the cases. We can bring the people to the table. You got to have support from prosecutors. You've got to have support from your city government, which we had. And you're going to gain and regain support from your community. And a big part of that was our faith community, ministers that came to the table with us. So if you can build that kind of coalition, if you can get people to agree, there is something really important to be done, and people are getting hurt every day, and we want to do something about it, and they'll all agree to work together, there is something that can be done.
Marty, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
You're quite welcome.
Marty Sumner is the chief of staff of the High Point, North Carolina Police Department. His department is a 2007 winner of a Harvard Innovations in American Government Award. For the latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development, we go to Planetizen assistant editor Nate Berg.
History provides many lessons, especially for cities. Places over time evolve, and what they do to evolve can be instructive for other places. Take, for example, Charles City and Parkersburg, two small towns in Iowa. 40 years ago, Charles City was devastated by a tornado, and more recently, Parkersburg was hit by another devastating twister. Those who lived through the Charles City tornado back in 1968 are hoping residents in Parkersburg will try to think of their current situation in the rubble of a natural disaster not as a travesty, but rather as an opportunity. An article in the Des Moines Register looks at how in the late 60s, Charles City was able to replan its downtown to be more vibrant and successful, a broad effort that was a direct result of the tornado. Officials who helped in the rebuilding effort are calling on the residents of the more recently devastated Parkersburg to think hard about how they too can not only rebuild their town, but how they can rebuild their town into a better one. And in Miami, officials are looking at ways they can remake and revive their struggling downtown area. An article in the Miami Herald reports on the emerging consensus in Miami that something needs to change downtown. With high crime, crumbling infrastructure, and a retail business core that has largely been stagnant for years, business leaders are pushing for a spark to relight the fire in downtown Miami. Many are seeing that spark in the recent condo boom that has put a handful of new towers in the area. Though many are concerned that the new residences aren't selling as fast as they'd hoped, there's still some faith that if the condos are there, the people will follow. But for the struggling businesses in Miami's downtown core, how long it takes to get those people to follow will be critical to how long they can stay afloat. And while downtown Miami's businesses are struggling, big box retailers are adapting. Retailers like Target and Circuit City are taking new shapes to fit into dense urban areas. A recent article in Architectural Record looks at how these multinational retailers are slimming their stores down to enter tighter and denser spaces in cities. This is relatively new territory for a retail model based around single-story warehouse developments on sprawling lots. While 10 years ago, only 1% of the nation's big box stores were located in cities, that figure has jumped up to 5% now, and insiders expect it to keep rising. But retailers are cautious about getting too deep into urban markets, as they're not sure if shoppers really want a big box shopping experience in a small box location. For PlanetiZen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor of PlanetiZen.com. While Marty Sumner's police department is cleaning up crime on the streets, Julia Kim is looking above the streets. Her group, Friends of the Bloomingdale Trail, is looking overhead for Chicago's next big public space. We'll talk with Julia Kim and hear from Walker Smith after this short break. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. In 1910, the Chicago City Council took a three-mile stretch of railroad track along Bloomingdale Avenue and elevated it above street level. By the 1990s, railway traffic on the century-old tracks had ceased entirely. But now Julia Kim of the Friends of the Bloomingdale Trail is looking to reclaim that unused space to create a three-mile park and walkway that rests 15 feet above the ground. Julia, describe the Bloomingdale Trail.
The Bloomingdale Trail is on Bloomingdale Avenue in north side of Chicago, and it is a proposed project. It is basically about 3 miles long, elevated 15 feet up in the air, and it goes through four neighborhoods: Humble Park, Logan Square, Wicker Park, and Bucktown. And eventually, we'd like for this future trail to connect to the Chicago River and eventually have a straightaway to the lakefront. So it really gives people in the northwest side of Chicago an opportunity to first appreciate the landscaping of the northwest side of Chicago and also a direct continuous connection to the lakefront, eventually down to Chicago River, and really embrace the natural resources, however industrial it may be, and use that as a way to provide more resources to the city and the neighborhoods.
How did 3 miles of elevated walkway, potential green space come to be available in the heart of Chicago?
Well, here's the deal. Obviously, in urban landscaping, green space is very difficult to acquire. It's very congested. There's not a natural park space that you could just capitalize and leverage in an urban setting. The elevated old railway line, it's still privately owned by Canadian Pacific Railway, has been unused for the last, since early 1990s. So it has just been sitting there. So what a great usage of raw space to incorporate into a greenway. And this isn't something that Friends of the Bloomingdale Trail thought of one night. It was really part of the city planning, where they were major issues in the northwest side of Chicago of lacking green space, which creates a lot of issues. There's physical activity issues, safety issues for children. There's 12 schools that goes along the embankment of the trail. Safe area for people to go as families and really start enjoying outdoor and green space. So that is tied in with just development of the city and really providing resources to community to get healthier and get more involved. And so that was a huge miss. So the city, along with Logan Square Open Space Plan, came up with an idea. Well, there's this old elevated railway line that's just sitting there, unused, and it could be a great source of land to develop a greenway. And so that's how the whole project started kind of buzzing.
So did this, so this was the city's idea, not a group of volunteers.
To give you a little personal anecdote, we've known about this trail living in that area for 15 years. People have been climbing up on and using it as a personal use, as it's a really cool visual to be up 15 feet up in the air and have this perspective of this beautiful city. It's very different from on the ground view. And so a lot of bicyclists, outdoor activists, runners, hikers have been using the trail on their own. So the city came up with it as they do research on park-starved neighborhoods, where Logan Square is the second most park-starved neighborhood in the Chicago community area in the Northwest. And Logan Square Open Space Plan specifically said, here's how we could see envisioning sort of development of greening the urban landscaping. There is the old Bloomingdale Avenue Railroad Embankment, still currently owned by Canadian Pacific Railway. How can we render this that it kind of falls into a development where we could provide more green space? In the interim, the private sector folks who moved into the area started using the trail unofficially, and that's how Friends of Bloomingdale Trail formed. It was formed on several volunteers who were activists in the area and really wanted to see this built the right way as a greenway versus knocked down and turned into condos.
So the city identified this as a potential solution to a lack of green space in a very congested or park-starved part of the heart of the city, really. And then the people in the neighborhoods were actually using the trail and decided we want to make sure it happens in the same way. And they simply organized separate from the city. So this is a, I would assume, a 501c3 nonprofit organization.
That's
Friends
correct.
Of the Bloomingdale Trail. And you are the executive director. You have a corporate marketing background, don't you?
I do.
And so how in the world did you get attracted from corporate marketing at, did you tell me, Levi Strauss & Company? So how did you go from marketing at Levi Strauss to being the executive director of this nonprofit?
I'm still trying to figure that one out, Carol. But in reality, there's actually a really logical transition. I got involved on a personal level. I live in Logan Square. I have a 5-year-old daughter, and I understand the challenges of lacking green space. And my husband and I are both outdoor activists. We love to bicycle, and we love to really enjoy the urban resources that we have in this beautiful city. So we got involved. The Friends of Bloomingdale Trail actually posted a position, and it was our very first paid staff member. I left Levi Strauss & Company to pursue other interests and wanted to work very close to home instead of commuting 3 hours to an office in the suburbs where my office was, and decided, you know, this could be something that I could feel really good about and be part of the process. So I interviewed and I got the job. Now, I think on the credit to Friends of Bloomingdale organization that they were pretty smart to hire someone with a corporate background. What they really wanted to do was strengthen infrastructure, develop board, and also really get the branding message of what this future trail holds. And it's really messaging, and I think that's what marketing is. It's really sharing knowledge and getting people involved to support a cause.
Somehow you've attracted Trust for Public Land into this mix of funders and supporters and advocates. And Trust for Public Land, I mean, is an outstanding organization. They raise funds for very special select projects around the country, and yours is now one of them. How did you wrap them into this?
First of all, we love Trust for Public Land. It is sort of our big partner. But basically, this is what they do. They like to turn unused land and give it back to the public and buy the real estate, do land acquisitions, and work very close with the city. They saw our organization as community stewards. And it's really difficult to have an organization that already have that connection to work with just a big project, the scale. Trust for Public Land, if you will, are like project managers of this future trail and working very closely with City of Chicago to acquire real estate. And as I talked earlier about the proposed 8 access points. So that is their area of expertise. And they're a project manager working along with the city. And then they've discovered us because they need a connect to the community. And Friends of Bloomingdale Trail is the direct stewards of the community and long-term stewards. This is a huge, exciting international project. I mean, it's not just a parcel of land to develop into an underground park. That's going to involve multiple organizations. What was formed out of that, led by Trust for Public Land, was the Bloomingdale Trail Collaborative. And that collaborative is made up of Friends of Bloomingdale Trail, along with Trust for Public Land, of course, City of Chicago and their planning department, Chicago Park District, Cultural Affairs. I mean, it's really involving private-public organizations. And it needs that type of teamwork. Otherwise, you would never be able to pull this off. And it's really interesting because we have such great close relationship with them because we are in a collaborative. And that is what's so special about this project. It brings a lot of these organizations together. And it's such a bigger part than just an elevated trail.
You've talked about this collaborative and you named its various members, but the land is still owned by the railroad. So talk to me about the relationship between this collaborative and the railroad and how the railroad views this land. I presume it's willing to sell, but at what price? And what does the railroad want in return?
From what I understand, the Canadian Pacific Railroad wants to, I don't want to use the word dump, but basically relinquish the land to the city. But before the city could accept the 3-mile elevated platform, they need to make sure that it is actually stable and you could build on it or convert it, whatnot. So initially, the city did do a site survey and found that the structure is sound enough to make the next step forward. So right now, we're sitting with the city. Now, they haven't bought it or taken it off Canadian Pacific Railway's hands yet, but they are connected. Any issues that arise, CDOT is on it and will say, trees need to be cut down. You need to come out here and cut the trees down. So they are still in a relationship, talking and moving forward every step of the way to transition. However, the city is very careful on making sure that it's one step at a time.
What is the problem with the Canadian Railroad just simply saying, here, City of Chicago, take this thing off my hands, I'm out of here? Is there resistance from the railroad to do that or the City of Chicago?
No, it's at the city's hand. Canadian Pacific Railroad would like to.
Okay.
I mean, sell it for a dollar if they have to. Right.
And the city's just saying, is it stable?
Yeah, and they did that. But they need to make sure it's cost more to destruct the embankment than actually to build on it. So a deconstructive process is highly costly. So the city doesn't want to have that in their hands unless they know it's, you know, something that we can move forward with to make sure that it's buildable, it's sustainable, and it's something that, you know, that you can't just say, we're going to buy it and that's it. It's a step-by-step process. The good news is that that city has acquired funding to move forward with a preliminary engineering process. So again, it's a step-by-step process. Preliminary site survey was done. Now they're actually committing to do the next phase, which is the preliminary engineering process. So they were able to secure about $2.3 million from CMAP, which is Chicago Metropolitan Area Planning. For this year, fiscal 08, they will have about $1.3 million to start the engineering process with the RFPs that will go out, working with their agencies. And we are part of that process as Friends of Bloomingdale Trail, the Bloomingdale Collaborative, if you will, with Trust for Public Land, will make sure that the RFPs are contributed with communities in mind, meaning all four neighborhoods, where, you know, what we do to provide support to the RFP is community visioning. We invite leaders within the community and also residences who should be part of the process. Everyone should be part of the process and feed that information in a data format to the city along with TPL. So then what's going to spring from that is that will also be a preliminary design workshop that TPL is leading along with the city and the collaborative. And then that's going to be the next step of incorporating all the data we've collected, and we'll feed that back to the city, and they will incorporate that to the RFP process.
It's really convenient for the city and Trust for Public Land to have you there. Really, in a really positive way, you're there to say, let's make this happen.
We're committed, and that is our job. That is what Friends of Bloomingdale Trail is. We are the long-term stewards to make sure that the future trail is designed with the people who will be using it. Yeah. And they need that input from us. We're a great partnership.
But the city would maintain it.
The Park District will maintain, but there's a lot of other work that will obviously happen in long term. The unique thing about this project is that it touches such socially, economically diverse neighborhoods.
Is there a problem with that? I mean, have these neighborhoods thought, well, maybe I don't want to be connected to that next neighborhood down the road?
Absolutely. Everything has its positive impact and negative impact. And I think that's where we come in as well as at BT, is that we want to make sure that all of you have an opportunity to either have a negative process or have a negative input that you want to be voiced, instead of not being part of the process of the designing and the building. And we do have challenging districts, you know, and I think that the four neighborhoods, Logan Square, Humboldt Park, Wicker Park in Bucktown, and connecting to North Avenue, you know, we have some neighborhoods that are afraid of gentrification, or neighborhoods that would say, well, this trail is not for us. It's for the new people moving in. But the future trail is for everybody. It's a public space. So it is welcome to be used by everyone in the neighborhoods and the city of Chicago. It's an extra resource and hopefully improve the quality of people's lives. So that's sort of our, you know, our mantra, that is always and will never change through any issues that we face, that it is a public space to be used by everybody in the neighborhood.
You're not the only ones working on elevated park trail space, linear park space. The High Line, of course, in Lower Manhattan in New York is well underway now. I'm kind of curious about why you think now, why the interest in these elevated trails is emerging in some pretty hot cities.
Well, I think that it's land space. I think that you have to be resourceful. There's actually three that exist in the world. There's one in, to my knowledge, one in Paris, Promenade Plantée, where I hear people like to neck and under the trail. You know, it's Paris, so, you know, what can you expect? There's also Beltline in Atlanta, which is a fantastic project, well needed, I'm sure, in that city. And also, of course, the High Line in Manhattan. Of course, you know, and this is me being a little bit of a Chicago bully, but ours is the most unique because it's 3 miles long. I think Paris is 1 mile, New York is 1 mile, and Chicago, it's 15 feet up in the air, 3 miles. And it connects very different neighborhoods with its rich culture. Chicago, it's a very neighborhoodly city. You know, it's not like New York and Manhattan where I always joke, everyone is wealthy. You know, in Chicago, you have the working class, you have your upper class. It's all sort of together in that 3 mile radius. So we like to think of it as a unique piece that it will connect those four communities. And that's where I want to touch upon some of the issues that I see living in Northwest Chicago, where if you live in Logan Square, you don't see a lot of people going to Bucktown, even though it's only 3 miles long. Well, I'm hoping that the trail will not only provide green space for exercise and outdoor activities, but also a commuting route where people will have an interest, if you're in the Bucktown in the eastern section, to go to the northwest section and see what the culture there is like. And I think that hopefully this will connect all the neighborhoods and communities where the barriers will be down a little bit.
You sort of told on me. I unofficially walked part of the trail recently, and there are a number of houses and condos that back right up to the trail. Are you getting any pushback from these homeowners to the trail?
And the funny thing is, they're embracing the trail. You know, some of the condos that is, I mean, you've seen it, up against the embankment of the trail. I mean, it's right there in their backyard, in the patio. There's some security cameras we saw on some of the houses. But, you know, those types of development will not be really seen again, because now that the trail is on the radar, the city is very specific on their ordinance plan and making sure that that type of development doesn't happen. Surprisingly, the residences are very receptive to the trail and want to know how they can support it. trail and want to know these people to participate and gather their thoughts. And what we've been doing is what we call community visioning program, and that is inviting leaders or residents into sort of a workshop session where we have, tell us how you would see, envision the trail being built. What issues and challenges do you see? Safety comes up a lot as a potential issue. So we want to, this is how we capture all the residents. We also have a members capacity list where we invite and partner with Chicago Bicycle Federation and other local organization that obviously has the same like-mindedness of the trail and supports the trail project, and start partnering with all these organizations to start inviting and having these visioning sessions. And then we're capturing it in a summary to publish. The pushback we get in a positive way are concerned citizens who do not want this sort of development happening, where it will be a blockage to the public access points.
Oh, interesting.
And more interested in, please, you know, we love this idea. We want to use it. We cannot have any more of this type of development near the embankment.
A lot of cities have abandoned rail lines. If I were sitting in another city and I saw an abandoned rail line and wanted to begin the process of converting it to a trail, what are the first two or three steps I'd have to take?
You have to start talking to your alderman. It really starts at a community level. And that's how we started, is that it was just volunteers who really had passion for, and this sounds really sappy in a sense, but leaving a better place and having a resource to ride safely where you're not competing with cars on Milwaukee Avenue. I know I got doored, you know, and having the right of way of in being elevated, it's just, how can you not get it started? So there has to be passion around it, and it has to be done at the grassroots community level, and then start inviting your aldermen, start inviting your political leaders, talk to your aldermen. That's how we got started.
And how did the conversation with the railroad happen?
Well, that was through, we had to connect with City of Chicago, a volunteer base, knocking on Mayor Daley's door, you know. Please, Mayor Daley, you have to, you know, take a look at this project. I mean, you know, we knew that he's all about greening the city. He's an avid bicyclist. He's done a wonderful job so far. And what a great idea. And what a great need. So there was this sense of urgency. And again, you know, it took a long time, but it's really knocking down the city's door, and they listened.
Tell me, what are the biggest challenges you face with getting this project to completion?
I think the biggest challenge is really getting everybody together, getting the challenging areas, you know, where in the Northwest side, they're a little reluctant to get this trail built. Getting everybody on board and working with six or seven teams to make sure that it gets built right. That's the most challenging thing, to make sure that the trail gets built so that it works for the people in the community and the city. A lot of these cases where people, they don't really know about the trail, the building process. And it's, well, here it is, enjoy it. And the biggest challenge is, how do you get it built right?
Julia, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Julia Kim is the executive director of the Friends of the Bloomingdale Trail. City View's commentator Walker Smith takes us behind bars this week to talk about the freedom we might take for granted.
In 1971, a team of researchers at Stanford University conducted a now infamous experiment in which they randomly assigned volunteers to be either inmates or guards in a simulated prison. The experiment was supposed to last 2 weeks, but was halted after 6 days because the level of abuse and humiliation had spiraled out of control. This experiment, widely scrutinized and debated, has been difficult to replicate because of the restrictions on field research that it precipitated. But there is one well-known replication called the BBC Prison Study that was conducted in 2001 in conjunction with the BBC, which filmed the experiment as it was being conducted and then televised it in 2002 as a reality TV show called The Experiment. The original Stanford research program has often been cited as proof that when people step into certain roles, they adopt the behavior and attitudes associated with those roles. It is disturbing to ponder the possibility that our morals and principles can be overwhelmed and corrupted merely by assuming some role in an organizational or social setting. In the BBC prison study, though, something different happened. The prisoners, not the guards, became assertive, leading eventually to a prison revolt and a surrender of control by the guards. At this point, most of the participants, guards and prisoners, joined together to create a power-sharing commune. But the commune collapsed after one day, at which point a new leader emerged who, with a band of supporters, set about creating an authoritarian regime even more repressive than the original prison. This led the researchers to call off that study 2 days short of its planned 10 days. The subjects in the BBC study didn't behave in accordance with their assigned roles, but they weren't unaffected by the experimental situation either. Social scientists continue to look at both studies for insights into the situational conditions that can turn people into tormentors. While the two studies differ in many ways, both show that there is more to oppression and despotism than individual personality in genetics. Social conditions can have a dominating influence. Whether power is used for good or evil is frequently dependent upon the characteristics of the situation in which it is exercised. This is why the foundation of civil liberties on which our nation was founded is so important. They constitute the situation within which power is exercised in this country. Yet, in our pursuit of other goals, we can be easily tempted to forego these fundamental safeguards. The ends are said to justify any means necessary. But as these two prison studies remind us, the means themselves often determine the ends. It's hard to wind up with freedom when, in its defense, you give it up. We know that in certain situations, people are less likely to abrogate freedom. So let's not abandon those situations. It is often said that freedom is not free. And perhaps this is no truer than when it comes to the price we must pay in order to preserve what it takes to live free. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his latest book is Generation Ageless. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. We'd like to hear what you think of the show. Email your questions, comments, kudos, and critiques to questions at smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.